please help me welcome our speaker tonight. It is Lauren S. from the Stove Touchers Group.
All right.
Hey everybody, I'm Lauren. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi Lauren.
Hello. Just get like a vibe for the audience here a little bit. I don't know, public speaking is not my favorite thing to do, so I usually kind of start my talks with that little disclaimer that I do better one-on-one. I am like kind of an introvert naturally, even though it doesn't seem like it probably sometimes, but I do better with like smaller groups and one-on-one stuff. However, if I'm asked to do something in Alcoholics Anonymous and it's like within my power to do it, I say yes. And actually I wasn't even asked to do this commitment. I like volunteered myself to do it. The main reason that I wanted to come down here tonight was for an announcement that I'm going to make after I speak. So you get to hear me speak and then you get to hear me speak more after I speak for the hour for an announcement that I'm going to make after that. But anyways, I just, it's public speaking is not my favorite thing to do because I have this self-centered fear, you know, and I have this thing that tells me that I'm not good enough. I have this thing that tells me bad things about myself and about other people. And I've learned to work with that, those narratives that I have inside of myself, and like basically not take them so seriously and not be so identified with them, but I still have them, you know. And so I just try to not really believe all the things that my head tells me, you know. I usually start with a couple things. Oh, I see, let's see who's on Zoom. I see Vicky. I can't see who the other people are, but hello to the Zoom people. So I usually start out with a couple things. I have a sobriety date. My sobriety date is February 7th, 2010. I have a sponsor, and she knows that she's my sponsor, like, too much, you know. I'm, like, often texting her and talk to her once or twice a week, and we do a lot of spiritual work together. And I sponsor other women. And I have a home group, and my home group is called Stove Touchers, and it's like a hybrid. So it's my sponsor is in Chicago, and so we do a hybrid. Like I Zoom in, a couple other girls that I sponsor, we Zoom in, and then she has the physical meeting in Chicago. And it's called Stove Touchers because of the reference in the big book that describes alcoholism as being different than that we don't have the type of defense that prevents one from putting his hand on a hot stove, right? So I put my hand on a hot stove and it hurts me and I pull my hand back and I say, I'm not going to do that again. And I don't do it again. But with alcohol, I drink alcohol, I do drugs and it hurts me. And it hurts everybody that I love. And I do it again and again and again. So that's the like little play off of the, you know, line in the book. So that's why we call it Stove Touchers. Because even today, I'm not drinking or getting high anymore. But I still, with other, we'll say, defects or handicaps or shortcomings or whatever, I can have that same thing where it's like, you know what, I paid a price for doing this behavior or doing this thing, and I'm going to do it again, you know? It's not going to hurt me this time, and here's how, right? And so I don't know. I hope that you guys aren't as slow of learner as I am, but I am a hard teach and a slow learner, and I typically don't grow spiritually and don't change unless the pain of staying the same has kicked my ass, basically, you know. And then I usually am willing to change. I don't change out of like some place of like virtue or good character or like, oh, this is better for me and I'm going to be a good girl and I'm going to do it this way, right? I change because my back's up against a wall and I'm in so much pain that I can't stay the same. And that's like a good summary of like the past 12 years of my sobriety too, you know? So, and just like thank you for like anybody that popped over here, you know, cause I mentioned it or like, you know, there's some of my friends here, some new friends, some old friends that we've been running together for years, you know? And, it just means the world to me that, you know, I have met amazing people in this program, you know, and people that we would do anything for each other, and that we've been in each other's lives for like a really, really long time. So I'm real grateful for that. So that's enough with like the introduction stuff, I think. So I'll just start like from the beginning. So I'm going to talk a little bit about what it was like and what happened and what I'm like today. And, so I grew up in Bucks County, two loving parents, younger brother. And I remember my first memories. I remember like feeling this sort of, I was just sort of like pure awareness. Everything was really magical. Like I remember being outside with my mom making mud pies and like doing, I have these snapshots of memories from my very early childhood that everything was like really, really kind of amazing and really peaceful and like okay. And what happened by the time I was in elementary school, I remember that in my like internal experience started to change. And my internal experience, instead of being like peaceful and quiet and free and like safe and everything was okay, that started to be replaced with a lot of thinking about how you're better than me and I'm worse than you, how you're different than me. Like I remember distinctly in elementary school watching other people like interact and like connect with each other. And they all seem to like really easily be able to, you know, talk and laugh. And then there was like literally me. Totally apart from and totally separate and like different. And I don't know, like I just didn't feel a part of and I didn't feel connected and I felt scared. And I don't know if the non-alcoholic, if the like not, you know, if the normal normies, there's one of them in the audience back there. I know that there's the non-alcoholic. I don't know if that's their internal experience, right? Like, but I know that it was mine. And that thing inside of me that told me that I'm not good enough and told me that no one loves me and told me, you know, all of that stuff, that just like grew bigger and bigger. And I remember being a little kid and like the teacher in school would like ask a question and I would know the answer, but I would be too scared to raise my hand because I didn't want other people looking at me. And then if I did get it wrong, I would feel embarrassed. Like, so there was like a whole lot of that kind of dialogue going on. And I think that it's important. The one speaker that I was listening to recently, she said like, you know, we come into Alcoholics Anonymous and the first thing we say to like, you know, like the sponsee or the new person is like, well, start with your drinking. Tell me about your drinking. And like, she says like, you can't like chop your life up into little pieces like that and just start with the drinking. It's like there was stuff going on beforehand that you just needed to pour the drugs and alcohol over top of me. And it just, you know, like there was something that needed to be treated by the drink and the drugs, you know? And so, because like if I hadn't found a solution in drugs and alcohol, it was a synthetic, like fake solution. It was like a delusion, but it did work for a while. If I hadn't found that, my head probably would have told me to kill myself, you know, because of the internal pain that I was in. And so when, What else was I going to say? And I'll just say this too, like, you know, in my childhood, like, my parents are kind of like, they were like on the cusp of like the hippie, like, punk rock era, you know? And so they, you know, there was a lot of partying going on in my house, and there was a lot of smoking weed, you know? And, like, I remember when I got to AA, like, my perspective of my parents were like, well, they chose drugs over me, and they made me this way, and it's their fault, and they did this to me. And, you know, it's just like the whole victim thing and a lot of that. And you know, when I went through the inventories and the step work and stuff, what I saw was that my parents would have given their lives for me to be okay. When I was out there, like, dying, you know, with mixed up in the stuff that I was mixed up in, they would have done anything for me to be okay. They would have given their lives for me. And they can do that stuff recreationally, and it doesn't, like, take them where it takes me, you know. So it just is, like, that's another kind of example of, like, the last 12 years of my recovery is, like, I think that I know, you know. Like, I think that I know how things are and how reality is, but it's like, really, I need to do the step work. I need to do the inventories. I need to be talking about my shadows and my ego and stuff, because the lens that I view reality through is this, like, distorted, self-centered, fearful lens, right? So it'll tell me, it's like, it just sees things like inaccurately. So I need to be, the solitary self-appraisal is insufficient, right? So me just, like, considering my own stuff and not running it past other people, not looking at it in a spiritual setting is, like, not sufficient if I want to be well, you know? So now I'll go to, like, when I first started to drink. So I remember, you know, specifically the first time that I drank was this guy had, like, left this bottle of vodka at my house, and it was, like, this shitty, like, bottom of the shelf Vladimir, like, $8 a gallon. I don't know. It's probably much more than that now, but it was, like, you know, bottom of the shelf vodka. And I didn't know what it was going to do to me or what was going to happen, but I didn't feel good inside. And I like suspected that it would probably change the way I felt. And this was all subterranean. Like, I wasn't actually thinking this, but it was, like, kind of like that was the experience. And so I drank that vodka, and I drank it, and I drank it, and I drank it. And it wasn't even like I was like in my bedroom by myself at my parents' house. It wasn't some cool party scene or, you know, like with some hot guy or something. It was like me by myself alone in my bedroom, you know? And I drank that vodka and drank it and drank it and drank it. And I remember vaguely, you know, being in and out of the blackout. And that spinning thing, you know, when you're lying, I remember lying down on the bed and putting my foot on the ground to try to, like, stop this spinning thing. And so, like, you know, I don't know if what makes me an alcoholic is when I put alcohol, per the big book, when I put alcohol in my body, I experience an allergy, an abnormal reaction to it, that once I put one in my body, the first one demands the second one demands the third one demands the fourth one, it kicks off an allergy, an abnormal reaction called craving. The book calls it the phenomenon of craving. In other words, the reaction is my body needs more. That's what makes me an alcoholic, is that in addition to the mental obsession and the spiritual malady. But, that first time, like, it was, I did drink alcoholically, you know, I drank, into a blackout, you know? And so I don't know if it was like the allergy then or not, you know, but, that was my first experience with it. And, like, I didn't have, I hear some speakers say, like, you know, that first time they ever drank or got high, they had to, like, they did it like every single second that they could after that, and like, you know, went to any lengths or whatever. And like, that wasn't exactly my experience. My experience was like, kind of slowly over the next 4 or 5 years, alcohol and drugs like took a more and more significant part of my life. And, you know, I remember being in high school and, you know, one of my dear friends that I've been friends with since elementary school is here tonight, and she'll remember some of these times. But, I found like my people, you know, the party people. I found my people. I found like, you know, kids that I was going to school with that like to get high and drink like me. And I remember feeling like this is like, I found like the key to life here, you know, like this is like the freedom. We would get the Black Label Southern Comfort and, you know, a bag of pot, and we would be like, I remember feeling like this love and this connection to these people, this feeling of ease and comfort, a magical feeling that I hadn't felt in, you know, I've been having this thing in my head telling me all these horrible things for years and years. And so to get that ease and comfort and freedom was really like, I found the answer to all of my problems here. And we, in those days, we were having a blast, you know. In those early years, we were having a blast. I wasn't paying any prices. It was like I could kind of shut it down and kind of, you know, still like show up for my responsibilities and go to school and like, you know, I didn't have to take care, like my parents were taking care of all the bills and all that, you know, so it was just like, we were just having a blast. And if it had stayed like that, I would have never stopped getting high or drinking. I would have never stopped if it stayed like that. But I have a progressive deal here with my alcoholism. In other words, it gets worse, never better. And, you know, the picture that I painted from the teenage years, what I experienced towards the end, the prices that I was paying were like outrageous. You know, it was like, let alone any, you know, self-respect or self-dignity or any of that went out the window a long time ago. But it was like what I did to my family, you know, what I did to the people that loved me, like that, there is a price that is paid with alcoholism, you know, and it made me choose to get rid of my family and pick the drugs and alcohol, you know. And that wasn't like, it's a subtle thing here because it's like, yeah, we have to take responsibility. I need to make amends. If I have caused harm, these people are owed amends for if I've hurt them. But it's also like, I think a lot of people, including myself, I came into AA like hating myself for what I had done to my family and the people that I loved. And like, I wasn't choosing to do that, though. I would never choose to do that to them. I was in the grips of something like way more powerful than me. More powerful than anything except God. Really. That's the way I see it. You know? So, anyways, we were having a blast and then at some point I crossed this line in my drinking where it's like an invisible line where I wasn't choosing to do it anymore. So it talks in the book about how we lose the power of choice in drink. In other words, I do it against my will. I do it whether I want to or not. So what would happen to me is like in my like maybe very early 20s, maybe I was like 20 years old, I crossed this line to where for the next, I got sober when I was 26, so for the next 6 years, I would wake up in the morning on most mornings and I would say to myself, you're not going to get messed up today. you're not going to do it today. And I meant it. And then by a couple hours later, my mind would start to say, now that was an overreaction. That it wasn't that bad. It would say something like that, or it would say, you're just going to do it one more time. I pursued that for you one more time, just tonight, then you're going to stop tomorrow. And that went on and on and on, you know, how that goes. So I crossed that invisible line where I couldn't stop even if I wanted to. And I had gotten into, like, legal trouble. This is when, like, the hospitals and the rehabs and the detoxes. I think I was in, like, 14 detoxes and mental hospitals, in and out. I'd go in. I'd get, like, maybe 3 days clean. And what would happen is the obsession was so strong. The obsession and get messed up was so strong in my mind. I would go into these detoxes and I would be there like maybe 2 or 3 days and it would start and it would say, you gotta go now. Like, and I would be calling somebody, checking myself out AMA because I gotta go get messed up now. It was like a very strong thing, you know? So that mental obsession would just take me back, you know, and that went on for a long time too. And I didn't really want to stop either, you know, like it says in the book, like we do this because we honestly want to, and we're willing to make the effort. And I didn't really want to stop. And the reason why I think I didn't really want to stop is because like, my version of reality, my experience of reality, abstinent, sucks. So if my solution, the ease and comfort, everything getting soft, feeling the internal freedom, was getting messed up. When I get messed up, all the problems go away, all the loud head stuff goes away. Now, let alone when, like when I've been living like how I was living, like all messed up, all the stuff that I had done to myself and the people I love, then I would come into consciousness and then all that would be on me too, right? So then getting messed up would soften that and it would make it all go away temporarily. So if what I thought was going to happen is you take that away from me, you take away the only thing that makes me feel like I can walk through this world and be okay, my internal experience is going to be full of fear, restless, irritable, discontent. I'm going to be having trouble with my personal relationships. I'm going to be unable to control my emotions. I'm going to be depressed. I'm going to be unable to work. You know, that's like my experience, abstinent. So, but what I didn't understand is the 12 steps produce the same effect that drugs and alcohol did, except it's like real. The drugs and alcohol was like smoke and mirrors, kind of. But this God, the 12 steps are just a roadmap to God, right? God produces the real thing, the real ease and comfort, the real peace inside, the real freedom inside. So the reason why I didn't want to get sober is because I thought it was going to be like doing time. You know, that's what I thought it was going to be like. So it's like, no, I'm not going to give up the one thing that makes me feel okay. Until just like everything else, it kicked my ass so much that there's nowhere else to go except that's like that one speaker, I think it's Bob Darrell, says like AA is like the last house on the block, right? It's like we try every other thing. Let me do anything else except be one of those God guys or whatever, you know? So I tried everything. My mom was looking into, before I came to AA, she was looking into sending me to Mexico to do ayahuasca. She was looking into, we were trying all kinds of stuff because I didn't want to go be one of the God guys, you know? Because I had a lot of prejudices against God. You know, and I thought that this was some kind of religious thing or something. I just didn't know. So I think that probably most people can relate to this, but it just got, in and out of detoxes. It got worse and worse. It progressed. And the other thing too, like what I was talking about with it, shutting all the head stuff down. When you get messed up, it gets it all quiet. It stops work. That stops happening. as, like, it didn't, it wasn't producing the same freedom that it used to. And so I couldn't get messed up enough to get free. Maybe one out of 10 or 20 times or something. You know? And so, and it talks about in the book when he can't imagine life with alcohol and he can't imagine life without alcohol, he will wish for the end. And that's when. That's when I started thinking about killing myself. I started to have those thoughts, and it just is, it makes me sad, you know, when I think about it. But, so that started to happen. It's like I was really lonely and like really messed up and really lost. And like I had cut out all the people that loved me. Like they had to go because they were getting in the way of me getting messed up. And so, you know, I was back and forth to Florida in rehabs. And I remember being down there and like living in my car. I had one of my front teeth was missing. I was probably like 110 pounds. Like, I was dying is what it was. And, you know, it was dark times, just like I think that probably everybody in here can relate to feeling, you know, that hopeless or whatever. So I just kind of all the lines that you say you're never going to cross, things you say you're never going to do. It's like that all went out the window, living, you know, sordid places, sordid people, dangerous people, bad people, you know, that's what I was all mixed up in. And, so I ended up, I was back and forth to Pennsylvania and Florida, and I ended up coming back up here, and, I was hanging out with my one friend that used to like get messed up like me, and he was like kind of not getting messed up at that point, and he was going to like this outpatient thing that's like they like babysit you during the day, and like you go there from like 9 to 3 or something, and then you go home to your house at night, and then you go back there for the day, like it goes like that. So he was doing that, and I'm like, maybe I should do that. And I started to go to this outpatient thing. And it was like, every day I'd come back in there and I'd be crying. And I'd say, I picked up again last night. And I'd go home and I'd get messed up. And I'd come back in the next day and I'd cry. And I'd say, I picked up again last night. I literally could not stop. I could not stop. And, I don't know why they didn't like kick me out. It's like probably generally protocol that they're like, you gotta go if you can't stay clean and stop drinking or whatever, but they didn't. And, so the one day my mom was dropping me off there, and as I was getting out of the car, I turned and looked at her and she was crying. And, she was like pleading with me to stay and like do like try it out at this place, like really please can you stay, you know, and can you try it out here. And so I ended up going to a halfway house. I did it like kind of for her. I'm like, you know, I don't know what, however, really why, but I went to there was like a halfway house affiliated with this outpatient place, and I went there. And so this is like kind of what happened. That was like kind of what it's like. And this is kind of how it changed. So I go to this halfway house sort of to appease my mom. And I really did. I kind of had this idea like, all right, I'm going to get everybody quiet here for a little bit. And then I'll stay living how I want to live, you know? And I thought, I pursued this delusion for a long time in my addiction. Like I thought that, I was smart enough that I could figure out a way to get messed up and like keep the damage down. You know, I just thought there was some riddle I just needed to solve the riddle or, you know, and then I'd be able to like use successfully and drink successfully. And, what does it say? Like, in the book that the obsession of every abnormal drinker is that somehow someday he will control and enjoy his drinking, you know? And I've never had success with that once I crossed that line, you know? But I thought that maybe somehow I could figure it out. So I agreed to go to this halfway house for like 6 months, and then I was gonna go back out or whatever, and that's like not what happened, because that was like, you know, almost 13 years ago. And so I go to this halfway house, and they make us go to, you know, it was like really, it was like kind of intense. It was like meeting 7 days a week, you know, relapse prevention and like therapy. And, you know, it wasn't, we didn't work. Like, we just went to like groups and meetings all day, you know. And I ended up here at this meeting, and I saw these two women here, and they had something. They were like smiling and laughing, and like, I didn't think that you could be happy and sober at the same time. I didn't think they existed at the same time, but they had something, you know. I could tell that they had something. And I asked one of those women to be my sponsor, and she like rocketed me through the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous as they are outlined in the book. And I had this like profound and deep, meaningful spiritual experience. And I don't know when that obsession got removed, but like, I don't think about getting messed up anymore. That's been removed, you know. I don't trust my thinking. I have all kinds of other wacky thoughts, but that has gotten removed. And that, for me, is like a biblical level miracle that has gotten removed. So, and you know, just to talk a little bit about like, this group is like so special to me, and like is such like a special place. Like, even coming down here, you know, this was my home group for a long time, and like, it just is like, you know, like all groups like change and evolve and like are different and stuff, but like, it just, it's, you know, it's a lot different. Like, when I was coming here in the early days, and there's a couple people that remember how it was in the early days, like 13 years ago, it was like this pocket of enthusiasm that there was no other groups like this anywhere around. It was like the 1 hour speaker meeting, solution based, big book oriented. Like, there were no other meetings. So people were coming from all over the place. We would get 200-300 people a night sometimes, you know. It was just like, I remember being new here, and like, I remember seeing some guy stand up here in a suit, and he talked about God a lot and stuff. And I was like, wow, you know, it's like really. And it was like kind of like this vibe, like, you come here and you couldn't give a bad talk, you know? It was like that kind of enthusiasm and stuff. And it just is, it's a real special place to me, this place. And it always has been and always will. It really is where I found, freedom, you know, and people that were gonna help me get out of this mess that I was in. So I ended up going through the work with that woman that I asked to be my sponsor. And like, I think that, you know, with my like first step experience, it wasn't, I have a lot of like intellectual understanding about the mechanics of the steps now in the book, and like, you know, have been through that process many, many times since that initial experience. But I believe that my initial experience with powerlessness in step one was like, I didn't understand. I remember my sponsor reading to me, and it would be like, bah, bah, but like, I wasn't even like, you know, absorbing it or understanding it, but I just took the action anyways. And, you know, so it's like, okay, what makes me an alcoholic? I have a physical allergy. I have a mental obsession. I have a spiritual sickness, which is why we work on the spiritual part here, and then the mental obsession and physical allergy is not an issue, because I heal the spirit. And so the spiritual malady drives the mental obsession and the physical allergy. If I heal that part, I don't have the mental obsession, therefore I don't have the physical allergy. Like, but I didn't understand any of that when I was newly going through the work. But what I believe my first step experience was that I knew that I was probably going to die if I stayed living the way that I was living. And like, I didn't want to die. You know, for the first time in a while, I didn't want to die. And so with that experience in my heart, and that's something that we can talk about the steps, we can teach the steps, we can show people the steps, that's something that you can't teach. You can't give somebody that in their heart, the willingness and the desperation and stuff. And so with that thing that I didn't want to die, and I thought that I probably would, I was willing to like do anything that my sponsor said, right? I don't have that same kind of desperation now. You know, I wish I did. But if she would have told me, I would have done, I did anything that she said. So it was like I was to call at 8 a.m. every morning. I called at 8 a.m. every morning. She told me to be somewhere. She told me get to the meeting an hour early, start looking for new girls, start greeting them. I did it. You know, I did all of it. And so, you know, and I think that moving into like steps 2 and 3 were like really hard for me because I was like, probably more like atheist than agnostic. Like I really kind of believe that like there's God stuff was a bunch of bullshit. And like, I remember saying to my sponsor, that sounds real nice, God, but it's like believing in like unicorns or mermaids or something. Like that would be really cool if something like that existed, but that's like a make-believe fairy tale kind of thing, you know? But what I didn't understand at that point was that's the whole point of the 12 steps is to get you to a higher power of your own understanding. Of course, you're not going to have it, or you're going to be traveling with a lot of agnostic stuff or whatever. But of course, you're, you know, not going to maybe have that relationship developed a whole lot because you haven't gone through the steps. That's the whole point of it. So, you know, we move into 4 and 5 and like, you know, I really have all these resentments at like my dad because he was always weak and he wouldn't stand up for himself. And I'm resentful at my mom because she's irresponsible. And, you know, I have all these resentments and my sponsor sits down and, it was like the most pitiful inventory. I look back on it now. It's like just a couple things written and like maybe some check marks or whatever. But it was like the one of the most profound experiences of my life doing this fifth step with my sponsor, you know? She started to say to me, we move over to the fourth column, which is my faults and mistakes. And she started to say to me, looking at, you know, stuff with my parents say, or maybe I'm resentful at employers or whatever. She starts to say to me, now what kind of daughter were you? And what kind of employee were you? And it was like, I had never looked at anything like that before in my life from an angle like that. And I don't think I stopped crying. I stayed at her house for 3 days. I don't think I stopped crying through that whole inventory. And I remember, I don't know if you can describe spiritual experience, but I remember driving home from her house after that weekend, and I'm driving, and it feels like the wheels of the car are not touching the road kind of thing. And I remember starting to feel like at that point, like, holy shit, like this might actually work. Like, cause it was always like, well, how long until I screw it up again? How long can I hold on for until it gets all messed up again? And I remember thinking, this might actually work. Like, I get it that it's one day at a time, but like, I don't want to ever go back to that way that I was living before. So I will do it one day at a time, but I want to do it one day at a time for the rest of my life. And so, you know, we move into 6 and 7, and I think that 6 and 7 really, like, my experience now is, like, it doesn't really matter the exact, like, defects and shortcomings. I don't think it really matters the specifics. What are the behaviors? Like, am I like gambling too much, or like have righteous anger, or like, you know, relationship stuff? Or I don't think that really matters. What I like to look at more is like, what's driving the behaviors. So like, it's always in my experience, fears or delusions that drive those behaviors. And that is like the exact nature of them. And that's something that like, I can't just be unafraid or not delusional. So like, I need God's help with that. Because I don't just can't like self-will my way out of being unafraid or something. So I like to look at that and like, you know, there's some other stuff, but I don't have time to talk about it right now. So, you know, we get into like 8 and 9 and I don't know, my amends were like, there were a couple people that were like, I don't really want to hear from you. Like, it would be too painful to hear from you. But most of the people were like, yeah, let's do it, you know? So the first person that I picked to make amends to was my mom. Because I knew she wouldn't, like, make too hard of terms with me, you know? Like, I felt like she wouldn't, like, kick me out or whatever. Like, she wouldn't, you know? So she was, like, totally willing to do it, you know? And so, like, I go to make amends to her. And, You know, I've been taught, like, with amends, like, you express, you don't just say I was, like, selfish or whatever, like, you express how you hurt them. And so I sit down to make this amends to my mom, and I'm, like, gonna talk to her about, I've talked to her about these things that I did for years of, like, constantly lying, constantly manipulating, constantly stealing money, constantly, there were times when I was living in Florida that she was calling the police stations in Florida to see if they find any dead bodies that look like mine, because she didn't know if I was alive or dead, right? How do you make amends for that, you know? So it's like I sit down and I start talking to her about this stuff, and it's obviously an emotional thing. And her response to me was, she said, I always knew that you were in there. I was just waiting for you to come back, you know? And when you, like, I've always been taught, like, you ask them, like, what can I do to make this right? And she said, in response to that, she said, I want you to help other people that are like you. Because you don't know, like, the healing that can happen when, like, one person gets better, like, everybody around them, you know, like, then they're okay, too, you know. So, like, I have done that to the best of my ability. I have followed through and lived in that amends. And I think, too, like, speaking of, like, living amends, like, it's probably, like, maybe 10% of the amends to, like, go and sit down and have this formal conversation with somebody. This is how I wronged you. This is what, you know, what can I do to make it right? I think, like, about the other, like, 90% of the amends is to show up for them. Do things with them, even when you don't want to, even when it's inconvenient, be in their lives. That's all the people that I made amends to. They just wanted me to be okay, and they wanted me to be in their lives again. You know, that was the main thing. So, and I think that, thank God that AA taught me to do that. Like, you just show up for people, you know? And, so then we, like, move into 10, 11, and 12. And I've had so many experiences with, like, step 10 at this point, because step 10 is, like, dealing with, like, when I, in real time, when I get disturbed. When I say disturbed, I mean, like, selfish, resentful, afraid, dishonest. Like, when those things rise up in me, these are the, like, actions that I take, and it's basically, like, well, the book says continue to watch, right? So I'm, like, watching my thoughts, you know. So continue to watch for my disturbances. And then when I see them crop up, you know, I ask God to remove them, and I talk to somebody about them, and I make amends if I've harmed anyone, and then I turn my thoughts to someone I can help. But I have, like, about, like, maybe 50 different versions of that, you know? So it just depends on what stage I'm going through and what's working for me, and kind of, like, just what, like, God, what do we need here kind of thing is what I try to say. And, you know, I certainly haven't been rendered white as snow in sobriety, so I certainly have stuff that comes up plenty. I don't know if I really do kind of feel like it's like some are sicker than others. I really kind of do feel like that is my experience sometimes. Like, I just have an aggressive mind and an aggressive ego, and so I have to continue to treat it. It's like, it really is like that saying, like, we come for our drinking and we stay for our thinking. Like, I still have alcoholism. That doesn't get removed. Like, I still have the alcoholic thinking, the extreme self-centeredness, the delusions, and like I was saying before, like, I, you know, it's good for me to, like, talk about that stuff and be transparent with it and do more work and stuff with, you know, with God and all that. And, you know, I think that step 11 is really cool in that it's like, okay, we've gotten you this far with God. Now, like, go find God. However you want. Like, go find God. There's, like, a million different ways to do it. There's a million different things that might resonate with different people. Like, go have some experiences, you know, with God. And it talks a lot in step 11 about inspiration and intuition and, like, the vital sixth sense. In other words, kind of being open to, knowing, like, which way should I go, and, like, how should I handle this situation, and, like, what is the right thing to do? And, like, I've been working with that a lot lately, and it is, I am amazed by, like, they say trust your gut or whatever. Like, really, when you tap into that, there's, like, an intelligence in that whole experience that really, I think that you can be quite guided through, really what God's will is for you and stuff. I spend a lot of time making decisions based on, like, you know, self-will, and I think about something and I want it, I'm just going to go get it, and I'll go and I'll forcefully, you know, go get it. I want to get an education. Well, I'm going to go get that degree, or I'm going to, you know, I want a new job. I'm going to go get that job. And it's like, that's fine. But I think that there's also maybe a little bit more room. There's been a little bit more room opening up for me, to be a little more tapped into the conscious contact with God and really being able to rely on that and trust that a little bit more. Step 12 has been, like, working with other people it's been such a mix with working with other people. I've seen a lot of people I've worked with, you know, this is not anything great on me, but I've worked with, like, hundreds of alcoholics and, had a lot of amazing experiences with them and a lot of really sad experiences with them too, because a lot of people don't stay here, you know? And, but I think that, if you're anything wired like me, where I like to think about my problems a lot, right? And, like, I think about myself and my problems and potential solutions to those problems a lot. And just, like, a side note too, like, the problems are created by the ego, right? So I'm in this state of, like, stillness and presence and awareness, and then the problem, like, rises up from the mind. There is no problem, right? It's not real. The problem rises up from the mind, and then the mind comes over and tries to fix the problem that it created in the first place. It's like this broken algorithm of this dance that it does. Here's the problem. Now try to fix it. No, that's not going to work. That's not going to work. That's going to work out poorly. You know, all that. It's, like, really kind of crazy. But anyways, I think about myself and my problems a lot. So when I get to work with somebody else and I'm thinking about them and I'm thinking about feeling compassion towards them and I'm thinking about how can I love them, like, I'm the one that gets the gift in that. Because I am relieved of the bondage of self, you know, in that process. And to be able to watch this thing in other people where people are, like, dying, and it's, like, something that you see in, like, a fantasy movie or read about in the Bible where they come back to life and they have this miraculous thing happen. To be a part of that is a real honor, you know, and to be able to say, you know what? Like, I know how that feels. I know how you feel. I lived that way too. I did that too. You don't ever have to do that again. And I can show you a different way if you want it. That's a great honor, for real, you know? I've talked a little bit about, like, you know, some of my current practices. I'll talk for just, like, really briefly about this thing that kind of I went through with COVID. It wasn't, like, really, I don't think, because of COVID. It just happened to be around that timing. But what happened was I started to believe some thoughts that I was having about, like, being an alcoholic and about being basically, like, exempt from alcoholism. And this is not, like, I didn't choose this. It wasn't, like, a conscious thing. But I just started to think, like, I don't really need to be talking about that issue. Or, like, I don't really need to be, real active in a home group. Or, like, these basic disciplines that I had been doing for all these years. My mind came in and started to tell me that I was different. And that I was, like, exempt from needing to treat my alcoholism like I used to. And it didn't, like, it's not, it was hiding from me too. It's not because like I'm bad or I'm immoral or like I'm like a rebel or something. Like it was hiding. I didn't know it was happening to me. And so like, I just am sharing about this because I think that with time, it is important to be talking about how the alcoholism can kind of go like subterranean and hide from us. It was hiding from me and it was telling me that, you know, I didn't have kind of alcoholism anymore. It wasn't saying that explicitly, but it was kind of like, if you looked at my actions in my life, that's kind of what it was saying. And, through a series of events and like a direct hit to the heart with like a bunch of painful relationship stuff and, you know, a big mess. I woke back up. I had fallen asleep in Alcoholics Anonymous and the ego was setting me up. I believe it was setting me up to probably drink again. You know, it is a cunning fucking thing, alcoholism. It's a sneaky thing. And so, you know, through this series of like extremely painful events, I was woken back up again. And I really had to take a good look at like what was really going on with that. You know, and getting real honest about, what I was up to and what I wasn't talking about, what I wasn't, you know, really bringing up to people. And again, not because of, it was hiding from me too, but it just is like a really bizarre kind of illness that we have, you know? So I think that I hope, you know, that I just keep my eye on it, you know? Like I had this experience, like I just still have alcoholism. I don't even have to get into it, but I still have a messed up head and I still have alcoholism. So anyways, I just am I thank you for having me tonight and, yeah, I hope it wasn't like too dull or like whatever, but, so now I'm going to make my announcement. Okay. So that's all I got.
No.